What's on your travel bucket list? Have you visited the Eiffel Tower, admired Mona Lisa at the Louvre, strolled the streets of Venice, Italy, or walked along the Great Wall of China? Well, these destinations and many others are central hubs for tourists, and while traveling can expand the mind and expose ourselves to new people, places, and ideas, our guest this hour says there's a dark side to travel and tourism as well. Good morning. I'm Cynthia Schuster filling in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 10:07 on Wednesday, May 29th. Our guest this hour is Elizabeth Becker, an award-winning author and journalist. She's covered national and international affairs as a Washington correspondent for The New York Times, was a senior foreign editor for NPR, and a Washington Post correspondent. Her latest book is Overbooked, The Global Business of Travel and Tourism. Thanks so much for being with here, Elizabeth.
Oh, it's very
for
nice
being
to be here.
My first question for you is, what got you thinking about the so-called dark side of travel and tourism?
Well, it's not just the dark side. It's the fact that it's a huge industry, and that's what got me thinking. Mm-hmm. My last beat at the New York Times was the international economics correspondent, so I would be going around the world looking at how globalization was changing economics and business. And I kept running into the travel and tourism industry, which was exploding. And it wasn't covered as such. You'd have some stories on airline industries, some on hotel and things, but it was the whole sector of travel and tourism that was beginning to rival the energy sector. And so I said, this is too big not to be looked at.
How did you first notice that?
Oddly enough, it was through agriculture. I was covering the Doha training round for the UN World Tour, Travel. I'm getting travel and tourism too much. Mm-hmm. For the Doha round for a new round of trade, and agriculture subsidies was holding it up. So I went to talk to the Minister of Agriculture in Paris, and noticed that at the end of my interview, he said, and all of this, of course, is very important for tourism. And I said, what? And he said, yeah, it's our biggest sector in France, and we coordinate with transportation and so on, and agriculture and so on and so forth to get to tourism. And that's the first time I just sat up and took notice.
Hmm. So how has your awareness changed the way that you travel?
Well, first of all, 5 years of research, I began to get some answers to some questions that I think we all have. Why are some places so crowded? Mm-hmm. Why do some places start to resemble each other so much? Why do inexpensive trips turn out to be very expensive? And how can I recover that sense of discovery? And that's what this book is about. And I organized it around the basic types of tourists we are. Some of us are cultural tourists. Some of us are consumer tourists. We love to shop. Others are nature tourists. We'd rather go on a safari than end up in New York. And then I wrote about, at the last part, I wrote about the two giants, the United States and China. And so, and by looking at it, starting to take it, that kind of an attitude as we would to any other serious topic, I began to see how tourism was changing whole societies, changing the environment, and changing cultures, sometimes for the good, but too often not for the good.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk a little bit about how many travelers come in and out of the country every year.
Well, globally, there are we hit the 1 billion foreign travel mark last year for the first time in history. That's very important because in terms of tourism, we were only at 250 million in the 80s. And then that's just people who travel from one country to another, not within their own countries. And then with the end of the Cold War, all of a sudden, nearly half the globe was suddenly open for travel and tourism. Just think the Iron Curtain, the Bamboo Curtain, kept peoples and countries divided. So all of a sudden, you could go to China, you could go to Russia, you could go to Vietnam, all Cambodia, Laos, so on and so forth. So that now it jumped from 250 million and then in the early 1990s to 500 million and then now 2012, 1 billion. And that means that around the world, one out of 11 jobs are tied to tourism.
I'm wondering if it was at all surprising to you in hindsight, after you realized what a massive industry this is, given that everything seems to be very profit-driven, there are always people among us looking for the next business opportunity.
I think I probably, like a lot of your listeners, I never thought of travel and tourism as a profit center. I always thought of, you know, that's what I do to have fun. I didn't think of it in terms of profit. So I didn't see it that way. And yes and no, because travel and tourism is about, underneath it all, it's about finding new cultures. And so I thought that protecting culture, protecting heritage, highlighting, you know, what is unique about who you are and where you live would be more at the forefront than it was.
Hmm. Talk a little bit about the local impact of tourism. Is it good or bad for the local economy?
Oh, that totally depends on how it's operated. Now, when you look at tourism, the product is the country or the local destination, the city. So if you don't have a good mix of public input as well as, citizen input, you're not going to necessarily have good for the economy. So if it's essentially a tourism where major hotel chains make most of the money, that's not going to be helpful for the local economy. If it is, however, say in Wisconsin you have some good agrotourism, where people travel around, visit your breweries, go to your dairy farms, and stay in local B&Bs, that will help your local economy. If you have local cultural events, some Oktoberfest, then that should help your local economy. However, if it's pitched as some places where it's all fancy boutiques that have their headquarters elsewhere, where it's hotels that don't leave any money in the local economy, that's not going to help you. And it could hurt you because you have to pay for all the wear and tear that those tourists, you know, give to your local area. And they may skew the culture so that you no longer have support for that pretty lake that all of a sudden is becoming polluted.
Mm. And we'll talk about some more specific examples of how travel is impacting local economies a little bit later. I wanted to ask you, who travels the most and what country exports the most tourists?
Well, that is in the process of changing. And surprisingly, it's becoming the Chinese. Not surprising, I suppose, because of the size of the population. But Americans are traveling less. We don't get there's dispute about the number of passports, but we are traveling less. When doing the research for my book, I was surprised at how happy people were to see an American traveler because they thought we'd stopped traveling. But the Asians are picking up. Europeans, of course, travel very much. As I said, we're not so much. In terms of receiving tourists, France is number one, and that's one of those countries that really does tourism well. Even though they're smaller than the size of Texas, they attract tourists. They attract more tourists than the United States or China. In fact, just 2 years ago, more Chinese went to Paris than all of the United States. That's how attractive.
Really?
Yep, that's how attractive France has become. And this is the fun thing about this research is that the way they have attracted is not only very good government and public coordination on the national as well as local level, but also because they believe that tourism should be based on protecting who you are. And so everybody considers the French very arrogant, culturally arrogant. Well, that's what has helped them so much in tourism. And secondly, they're one of their main philosophies is that you create a kind of tourism that the locals like, that you do your restoration, you do your development for the people who live in the community, and then the tourists come.
Hmm. But what are some examples of that?
Well, in France, it's the city of Bordeaux, and I go into that at some length in my book. It was a mess. It used to be in the 18th century, it was one of the most beautiful cities in Europe, and they'd really gone to seed. The river port was awful, and the buildings never had been restored. They were dirty. And then a mayor, they had a very talented, nationally ranked mayor, Alain Juppé, who later went into became the Minister of Defense and Minister of Foreign Affairs. But the mayor said, okay, we can do this, and talked with the locals, you know, the people who live in Bordeaux, and said, what do we want? And they wanted to clean up the buildings, restore them to their beauty, clean up the river port, get rid of all the old shacks, turn it into a park area that they would enjoy, make huge pedestrian areas of the old city, and then have light rail to connect different parts of the city, as well as a better train connection to the rest of the country. And it worked brilliantly. It's the equivalent of sort of the Boston Big Dig, mm-hmm. where they got rid of the old freeways that were a mess and put a lot of stuff underground and made Boston a beautiful city again. And in both instances, it creates a beautiful city, and tourists come to see it.
Hmm. Now, when we think about environmental impact when it comes to travel, it's easy to for our minds to go straight to carbon emissions, you know, mm-hmm. and what's going to be burned as we try to fly across the ocean and all that. What other environmental impact should we be thinking about?
Well, air, land, and sea, all three of them. And the sea was a surprise for me. You think the ocean is so huge that there would be very little problem, but those cruise ships that people take so much, they're sort of like, I call them the fast food of tourism, because they emit an amazing amount of pollution into the sea and into the air. And unlike airplanes, which are regulated, and in Europe, Europe has has a tax on carbon emission now, mm-hmm. Within your airplane ticket. And unlike, you know, your hotels on land, which the locals totally regulate, there's nobody really regulating those ships out at sea. And the Environmental Protection Agency has made some new rules about what kind of fuel the ships can burn when they come into a port. And a lot of ports are saying when they get to the port, they cannot idle with those polluting engines of theirs, and they have to turn those engines off and plug into an electric source. There's, but when they're out at sea, there's no international navy that's watching them, and they dump a lot of pollution. And it does very much hurt the ocean because they take the same paths. And there are all kinds of fascinating studies about the problems these ships are creating. However, as I said, there's no one in policing and enforcing any kind of environmental regulations.
Mm-hmm. Our guest is Elizabeth Becker. She's talking about the hidden cost of travel and tourism, not just personal monetary costs, but costs to the environment, indigenous cultures, and local economies. We're coming up on a break here, but we'd like to know, are you a world traveler? Do you think about the possible hidden consequences of taking your vacation? On the other hand, given so many people are working in the tourism industry, I'm wondering if you work in the travel industry. What do you know that you wish travelers knew as well? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. You can also email talk@wpr.org. I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Kathleen Dunn. We're talking about the vast industry of travel and tourism and some of the things we don't necessarily think about as we're sitting down to book our next flight or plan our next vacation. Our guest is Elizabeth Becker. She's author of Overbooked, The Exploding Business of Travel and Tourism. We have linked to her website on our Facebook page if you'd like to check that out at the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. We're also taking your calls at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Elizabeth, I'm wondering, how has mass tourism changed cultures across the globe?
Several things have happened. If I can, let me use the example that I use in the book, Cambodia, which is one of the most culturally rich countries in Southeast Asia. It just opened up to tourism after the Cold War in the mid-1990s. Tourists naturally are attracted to the glorious temples of Angkor. And if those temples were properly regulated, it would be fabulous. But they've been inundated by millions of tourists every year. The government has allowed a lot of hotels to spring up when there's not enough water for them, not enough sewage links, so that the local rivers are polluted. And a lot of the money from all of this is going to either back to the capital, to corrupt officials as well as corporate people, as well, and very much to foreigners, so that the local people have seen their per capita income drop. And the temples themselves are taking a beating. Some very dedicated archaeologists are trying to restore, repair, and all that sort of stuff. But when you have several million people coming through every year, the actual footing of the temples are dropping, sinking, and these temples that were meant for just the few people to be in meditation and prayer are now flooded, and so a lot of the artwork is being damaged. So it's the friezes and the parts of the building. So it's hurt the physicalness, and then it's also hurt the culture, because a lot of this tourist is bringing some really bad stuff. And the thing that I think will most bother people is sex tourism. With all these wealthier, largely men coming, they buy young women and buy them from pimps who have just bought them from families, and it's become a really big scourge in the country. And if you don't have a government that's going to be controlling it, you have that. You also have the instance where people like to go and think they are helping a poor country, so they do things and help at a local orphanage, for instance. Well, Cambodians figured that out, and now there are a lot of scam orphanages, so that people put their kids in an orphanage so that they can make some money from naive visitors. Mm-hmm. On and on and on, so that it's like this huge influx of money, and how do we fleece the tourists? This distorts the culture.
Wow. You traveled there with your daughter, correct?
Yes. I started, but I've known that since, I've known Cambodia since the war of the early 1970s. I started my career as a war correspondent in Cambodia, so I've known it in war, revolution, and peace. But
okay.
Yes, I took my daughter there, and then later I took my son.
So what were your children's reaction to Cambodia, or what was their perception of it, given that, or did you give them some background knowledge first?
Well, they knew a little bit about it, but it's one of those countries that's just stunning. So they said, Mom, why do you complain so much? It's so beautiful. And then I sound like the old fogey who says, oh, if you only knew it before. But so there's always that. But even they were amazed at the crowds at Angkor. Just how can you do it? It's like allowing crowds to go into Notre Dame and completely disrupt the mass and crawl all over the building. I mean, it's that kind of... Whew, this is a sacred space, and it's become the mad shopping in a after Christmas sale or something.
I had that feeling when I was inside St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York City.
Really?
In December a couple of years ago. It was just, yeah, there was a mass going on, but there were, I would say, 100 people in the back trying to take pictures and milling about and all that.
It's crazy. And one of the things I asked when I would interview these people, I said, do you go to church at home? No. Do you volunteer at orphanages at home? No. So, I mean, one of the things that, one of the takeaways I had was to be a really, as you just said, be a, how do you change your way as a tourist? Get to know your own city or state better. Go to museums, go to churches, understand more about where you're from, so that when you go to another place, you'll understand what those locals feel. And then secondly, do an awful lot more preparation. Read some books before you go. Do a lot more search on the Internet. And then, above all, see if in somehow one of your connections, a friend, a family member, somebody you work with, has someone in that place so you can know a local when you get there.
Mm-hmm. Now, on the other hand, you point out Bhutan and their approach to tourism. Can you mm-hmm. talk about that?
Well, there's a lot of ways to control tourism, and one is through the number of hotel rooms you have. And Bhutan keeps track of how many hotel rooms they have so that they can limit the number of tourists. Now, we do this in a different way, in the sense that we control the number of hotel rooms in our cities by zoning. Right now I'm on a book tour, and I've been invited here by New Orleans because they're having a lot of these issues of too many tourists. And a lot of places sneak around the zoning and illegally allow people to stay in their house, sort of the illegal bread and breakfast kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Which, couch surfing, maybe.
Yeah, or Craigslist, whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
Airbnb, whatever you want to call it. And now young tourists say, oh, this is so wonderful for us. We get to know the locals. Well, in fact, the communities are getting very upset because they're turning their residential neighborhoods into commercial enterprises. That's the dividing line here, is that first of all, make sure that the people who live there, you know, are able to have the homes that they want, that it's their lives, and don't interfere like that.
How do policymakers determine how to strike that balance, though, between having just enough tourism to help the local economy, but not too much that it starts to be a detriment?
Well, first of all, I don't think that conversation happens very often. I don't think it's a public conversation. I think a woman or man has a hotel and they want to build more, and they get the permit from the economic development side of the city council, say. But actual hearings where the whole community can come out and say, we want to keep this area this way, and then the city says, okay, then we have to do it this way. I don't think they have that, because in the United States, we don't take tourism seriously. The thing that is remarkable is how we're the only major country that refuses to have anything resembling a ministry of tourism. Nothing. We used to have something like that in the Commerce Department, but during the 1990s, when the Republicans took back control of the House in Congress, then Speaker Newt Gingrich said government should get out of tourism and zeroed out the budget for that agency. And since then, the Republicans have been really fiercely against even discussing a government role in tourism, and that sort of filters down. If you don't have a conversation nationally, it's harder to have it locally. And then along with that, traditionally in our federal system, states have been in charge of their own tourism. Like you have a Wisconsin tourism agency, yes?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, and that budget comes from your already strapped Wisconsin treasury, and they're probably cutting it like crazy right now. So who in Milwaukee is having the public hearing on tourism? Who in Madison is supporting a new look at how we have tourism? What kind of, because you can determine the kind of tourist you have. If you have a certain kind of rugged lakeside resort, you're going to get one kind of tourist than if you have a casino in the middle of town. And those are kinds of conversations that aren't happening. And and if you do a freelance, piecemeal kind of decision-making process, you're not going to get the tourism that everybody has decided we want, or one that is necessarily going to help the local economy.
Mm. I wanted to ask you about Venice, which is a tourist hotspot as well. What's happened to Venice as a result of consumer tourism?
Well, it started out, of course, cultural tourism, because it's been called, I think, quite rightly, the biggest open air art masterpiece in the world. The city is unbelievable. It's all canals, no cars. It remains this amazing labyrinth of beautiful sights. However, tourism has not been reined in, so that tourism is literally taking over the city. I'll just give you two figures to begin with. there are less than 60,000 year-round inhabitants of Venice, Venetians.
Okay.
24 million visitors come every year.
Wow.
Now, the effect is turning it into a Disneyland. The people, all those tourists drive up rents, so that if you're struggling middle class, you're going to probably end up having to give up your apartment and move to the mainland. Even with the city trying to subsidize, it's just crazy. Secondly, if there are fewer inhabitants, you lose your local school. You lose the local butcher and the pastry shop and the bakery and all those things that local people need. And instead, you have these T-shirt shops and masks and souvenir shops that they don't need. And, Venice was the home of incredible artisans, most famously Murano glass and fabrics and paper. Well, it's very hard to find those anymore because they've been pushed out by cheap imitation copies of them. So Murano glass is not made in Venice, but is made in Eastern Europe or Asia. And the local government is encouraging that kind of tourism to the detriment of the locals. And it's, there's fancy tourists and busloads of tourists who come for 1 hour or 2 hours looking at St. Mark's Cathedral and then go shopping at fancy designer shops that they could shop at their own home, whether it's Gucci or Ralph Lauren. They're all right there by St. Mark's Cathedral, and it's totally disconcerting. Mm-hmm. They're parts of the city that Venetians won't tell foreigners about because they want to keep it to themselves.
Our guest this hour is Elizabeth Becker, author of Overbooked, The Exploding Business of Travel and Tourism. We're discussing the unintended consequences of traveling the globe, what is happening to local economies and cultures, as well as the environment. Let's take a call from Jerry in Milwaukee. Hi, Jerry.
Good morning. How are you?
Good, Jerry. Could you speak directly into your phone so we can hear you a little bit better?
Can you hear me now?
Yes, thank you.
You're talking about one of my favorite subjects, and I can speak with her about her, that is your guest, for about 4 hours on this, but now in a minute. I'm well-traveled, and now I live in Milwaukee, but I used to live in the Caribbean as well. Let me just give you 3 points, for instance. As far as the dark side, if I go to a travel agency here in Milwaukee, for instance, and say I want to go to Antigua, the first thing that comes out is all-inclusive. With Antigua, Aruba, Jamaica, it's always all-inclusive places to go. Well, actually, I always said to myself, I've been traveling for over 40 years. Why go to Antigua and stand along all-inclusive when you can go to Florida and get the same experience? The beach is a beach. But meanwhile, the owners of the resorts are the ones to make money. The people who work there, who clean their rooms, and are bartenders, are very, very nice and accommodating, but they are slaves. Mm. If you tip the bartender at the typical all-inclusive resort, they can get fired. They won't tell you that as a guest, but they will be fired.
Thanks, Jerry. Let's talk about that just a little bit, Elizabeth Becker. When we go to these resorts, we're treated like royalty, but how are the employees being treated?
Well, Jerry makes a very good point. Thank you so much for bringing that up, because I think the Caribbean countries have been really hurt hard by that kind of tourism. First of all, not all of the resorts are that way, and there are some really good ones, but yes, the majority do. The money, it's called money in, money out, and the resort owners are not locals, and it goes directly to the corporation, and the locals are paid some of the worst salaries, whatever they can get away with. And that's why when people talk about volunteer tourism or anything, or doing nice things for the people you're visiting, I say the best thing you can do is overtip. But the International Labor Organization in Geneva works with unions to try to change that. And the hospitality unions in the United States and around the world are the ones that are now one of the few that are growing because of this, exactly what Jerry was talking about. So thank you, Jerry, for that phone call.
And let's talk about the divide between rich and poor in some of these places. It seems that, I forget which country it was, maybe it was Cambodia, where once tourism became one of the means of building capital, that money was going to the elite, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. Well, this is also part of, like any good government, if you don't have a transparent government where you can see who's making money with public resources, you're going to find this happening. In this instance, the government would simply declare something an economic zone, such as the beaches along the Gulf of Thailand, and that had been public land, and they sold it to foreign corporations for resorts and things, and you can't trace the money. Where did it go? Mm. The same with casinos, the same with the hotels around Angkor, building new hotels, new airports, that sort of thing. So that, yes, if it's not a transparent system, that foreign money doesn't get to the national treasury, much less down to the place where the tourists are visiting. And then you do have, like anything else, you have a division in the tourist industry. When people get money, what do they want to do? Most often, they want to take a very cool trip.
Mm-hmm.
That's, honeymoons, you name it, any excuse to take a really cool trip. And the really cool trip, presumably, they think, is to spend, to get the high-end luxury stuff so that you're seeing the divide in tourism that you see around the globe. However, the numbers are such that the middle class are also traveling.
How is travel and tourism, building images of let's say the American culture abroad?
Mm-hmm.
I was struck by an example you pointed out. Children in Africa were asked what they wanted to be when they grow up, and what did they say?
They wanted to be tourists because all they do is sit around and eat all day.
Yeah, that was something because, we're all guilty of that, I guess, at some point in our lives. What does that say about how they feel about tourism, or is that are they making the distinction between tourists sit around and eat all day, or are they thinking Americans, Europeans, they all sit around and eat all day? This is what they do in their home too.
Well, it's changing like so much, and done cleverly, as the Chinese have done, it can turn tourists into diplomats. The Chinese, when they opened up in the 70s and 80s, after being a very, very closed country, Deng Xiaoping, who was the architect of that opening, said, I want to use tourism not to make money only. Of course, we want to make money, but I want to use tourism to change the image of my country, to change the image of China. So the Chinese government has very carefully made sure that when tourists, like we Americans, go to China, they come away with a strong image and that they like China afterwards. The guides, the official guides, all take tests that include tributes to the wonders of modern China.
Mm-hmm.
And this is nationally determined, so it doesn't matter which part of China you're going to go to and whether you think the guide is local or whatever, he or she has passed that same test. So tourism is most often the best kind of public diplomacy. Now, how do those tourists look to the people who are in a poorer country where they go by in their air-conditioned limousines? That's another issue. And most often than not, it's a question of envy. And that's something we don't particularly want to have. And it European-American, I don't think it makes a lot of difference. There's an envy. And that's why some of the younger, newer tour guide people are very much pushing bicycling tours. I'm sure your listeners have gone on a bicycle tour at some stage, either in the United States or elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where the division between tourist and local is the least, and where you might, that kind of problem doesn't exist, and it's the best in terms of public diplomacy on both ends of the stick.
Interesting. We're talking with Elizabeth Becker this hour about the hidden cost of travel and tourism. She's the author of Overbooked, The Exploding Business of Travel and Tourism. We're taking your calls at 1-800-642-1234. Our lines are full, though, so try emailing us at talk@wpr.org. I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking with Elizabeth Becker, author of Overbooked, The Exploding Business of Travel and Tourism. We've got Harry and Madison on the line. Hi, Harry.
Hello. Well, I guess I had an experience early on in when I got out of college in the early 70s. I did what has become referred to as the hippie trail, that had people going from Europe to India on the overland route, and got to go to Afghanistan a couple times before the country had its present situation. And in those days, other than Kabul, there was no infrastructure for tourists at all. You just stayed at the tea houses or, you know, wherever you could find a place. But 25 years later, after raising a family, my wife and I joined the Peace Corps, and we went down to southern Belize, and we were placed in the highlands up in the series we were in one little Mayan village, but there were a number of Mayan villages around there, and that was when the first time I heard the term ecotourism, and we got involved with what had been a previous Peace Corps volunteers project called the TEA, the Toledo Ecotourism Association. And what they did was they built guest houses in these small Mayan villages that were, they're very isolated and difficult to get to. It's usually an old school bus and takes, you know, 3 hours to get there by 30, 40 miles. And these are villages with usually no electricity, no running water, and you stay in the guest house, and then the people come to the guest house, and it's arranged that families in the village that participate in this project have you come to their house, and then they feed you a meal that's prepared. It's usually called a chicken soup, but you struck the note with envy. What this was done, and I noticed living there for 2 years, that there's a large degree of envy when you have a leveled agrarian tribal group like that, that you need to pay attention to allowing a lot of participation and allowing everybody to have a shot at their handicraft being sold to these guests, these visitors that come to the village, and also having that noted that you are a guest when you come into this, and they're going to take you to their home, and you're going to integrate for a moment or for a meal with the family. And when it works, it's very cool. There are instances where people just are not prepared for the kind of things you have to give up to have that experience of, you know, basically experiencing life as an indigenous person in a rainforest.
Sure. Well, Harry, thank you so much for calling in with your experiences. Elizabeth, he brings up the topic of ecotourism, which seems to be picking up steam.
Yes, and in my book that I visit and explain how it started in Costa Rica, which is one of the great pioneers. And Harry just gave a perfect description of that kind of tourism. Costa Rica started it in part because they have a rugged country that wasn't prone to agriculture or anything, and so they said, instead of cutting down our trees, we're going to turn it into public parks and national parks and build ecotourism, and it's been a great success. And it's exactly as he said, locals share their country. They treat people like guests, and it's been an extraordinary environmental success. It's now, I think Costa Rica has more bird species than all of North America. They are home to numbers of butterflies and mammals that they're the wintering home, and they're an incredibly important source of protection. And that's in large part because they were able to figure out how to turn their national environmental treasure into a money-making ecotourism operations all over. Some are better than others, no question. Some are scams. But overall, it's not only works, but it's the leading economic engine in the country.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering what resources are available to people who want to know which tours are going to be the legit ones, which ones are the scams.
Well, there's first of all, the UN recently started a program that certifies this, and I mentioned that in the book. And there are the National Geographic has a very good website. There are the United Nations World Tourism Organization has a good website, and through those you can then see what kind of certification you're looking for, and also learn how to see through some of those scams. But it's relatively new, but there are new responsible tourism. There's responsible tourism, geotourism, ecotourism, all kinds of names, but basically some very good resources.
Great. Well, we'll go next to Corey in Mequon. Hi, Corey.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well. How are you?
Good. I just got back from a semester long in Rome, and it was just interesting. I lived across the street from the Colosseum, so I got to see a lot of tourists every day on my way to class, and also living in that neighborhood right next to the Colosseum, there's a lot of inauthenticity around there. A lot of fake restaurants where I lived right above a grocery store, and I saw one restaurant go in, and the employees were buying frozen pizzas, and then they would serve them up later that day. So that kind of stuff to me was kind of sad being there, but at the same time, being there for as long as I was still able to find more of the authentic places to go.
Thanks, Corey. That's an interesting point. We've been talking kind of about tourism as though tourists are being imposed on the locals. In other cases, there are the locals are catering to the tourists.
Oh, yeah, there's no question. There's all kinds of scams. And that's, I think all of your listeners are coming to the same thing. Beware of these inexpensive package tours. The reason they're inexpensive is that most often they're inauthentic, and that's whether those the cruise ships I mentioned, or which are they barely even come close to discovering the culture, but also the tour buses. Where are they going to take you? I mentioned scams in every single country where you don't get the real food, you don't get to talk to locals, you're in and out here. If it's you're on a tour and you're going to have that frozen pizza. So be very careful about your all-in-one tour, and be very careful about zipping in and out. I think take fewer trips and spend much more time planning them, and then when you finally get there, be like our friend who was a student at Rome. Spend a little time and get to know it.
Mm-hmm. Let's go next to Ernest in Hayward. Hi, Ernest.
Hi. We have a heavy seasonal tourism in the Northwoods, Wisconsin. I used to be a night clerk in a motel, and we were overbooked on summer weekends, but much of the rest of the off-season we had vacancies, which translates into expensive, overbuilt infrastructure. I remember telling someone from the city who was complaining about the high rates, I said, look, the rates would be even higher if I wasn't working for starvation wages without any benefits. And if tourism promotion is successful, as they say it is, that's got to only increase the amplitude of the boom and bust, because you can't get people up here in the cold off season like you can in the overcrowded summer season.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting point. Las Vegas, believe it or not, has had a similar problem, even with their balmy weather year-round. When China opened up their gambling in Macau, all the big rollers left Las Vegas. They lost billions of dollars. So to avoid what you experience in the North Woods, they moved to conventions and events. And the city as a whole put a lot of thinking, how do we do off-season, especially how do we do middle of the week? And for a lot of places, getting, you know, I don't know what you would have in the North Woods, but I'm sure there are lots of conventions you could imagine. I imagine there are conventions and meetings you could have, but it's something that in the business is called MICE, meetings, incentives, conferences, and events. And that has been the way out for a lot of largely tourist, overbuilt tourist infrastructure, as you described it in the North Woods, is to have people come off-season with meetings.
Thanks for your call, Ernest. I wanted to ask, we were talking earlier about ecotourism and some of these places that are kind of disappearing before our eyes. One thing that struck me was the New York Times book review that featured your book. And the headline was 100 Places to Visit Before They Die.
Yes.
I'm wondering what your reaction to that was.
Well, I thought very clever. and I don't know that... Not so much die as sort of melt away.
Yeah.
100 places to visit before they start looking like every place else. And that's one of the big themes, that people are very divided on this. Some people just want to go to the same Marriott hotel, whether they're in Mexico City or Beijing or Paris. Others want to visit the local and keep the local alive. And before they die, I think, you know, it's 100 places to see before you die. But the places are dying a cultural death, they're dying a social death, and an environmental death. And that's what I thought it was very clever.
Well,
I hadn't thought of it that way. But that's the fun thing about writing a book. People tell you what you wrote.
That's right. Well, one last call. We've got Julie in Barron County. And, Julie, we only have about a minute left.
Sure. I just wanted to encourage people to think outside the box and start with where you would like to go rather than booklets for tourism. I'll give you my example quickly. I went to India a few years ago. I had been there before, and the tour I was on went to the typical places like the Taj Mahal and the Red Palace in Jaipur, and they're heavily touristed. I really wanted to go to Amritsar, which is where the Golden Temple is, which is the Sikhs' holy place. And it was every bit as impressive as Vatican City or the Taj Mahal, and because it's not heavily touristed, it was cheaper, it was better, you weren't assaulted by hordes of people. It was the most wonderful part of the trip. And there really is something to be said for not following the horde cookie-cutter factory mentality, for finding a place to go and enjoy and get something cultural out of it and put something into it as well.
Thanks, Julie. We have to say to that, Elizabeth.
It's interesting. All of your, you have a very sophisticated audience. She's absolutely right. And that used to be easier. It used to be easier to make those trips when there weren't a billion of us traveling. And that's the one thing that I suppose I would like to leave people with, is that this is a very crowded planet. And going off season, doing all your homework and figuring out where you want to go, as Julie just said, is very important. Because at the end of the day, if we love a place to death, which is what's happening to Venice, then it's not going to be there anymore. So we have to think about protecting the places we love, both as tourists and as people welcoming people, other guests, to our place, which means as citizens, and make this a political issue as well as just a how do we behave as tourists issue.
So in our last minute, as we sit down and think about our next destination, what's the first thing we should ask ourselves?
Why do we want to go there? And then if you can answer that with any kind of clarity, then you'll figure out how to make this a special trip for you. Have a budget. And I think if you have a budget, you're going to find those out-of-the-way places like Amritsar that Julie just mentioned. And as I said, spend as much time as you can preparing for it and possibly even learning some of the language. I always recommend that. And then leave enough space in your itinerary so that you can be surprised by something.
Great. We'll have to leave it there. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, I enjoyed it very much. Thank you.
Our guest was Elizabeth Becker. She's the author of Overbooked, The Exploding Business of Travel and Tourism. She's telling us about the vast industry of travel and tourism here in the United States and across the globe, helping us understand some of the impacts and unintended consequences of traveling. You can find an archive of this program at WPR.org, where you also find out what's coming up tomorrow. Kathleen Dunn will be back with you. I want to thank Rhonda Fanding for producing and directing this hour, and Dave Potraz for on-air production. I'm Cynthia Schuster in for Kathleen Dunn here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Stay tuned for the Larry Mueller Show coming up next on the Ideas Network.